My name is Richard Capes, and this is a morethd.blogspot.com interview with philosopher, teacher, and radical activist Derek Jensen about his book Dreams. Okay, Derek, my first question is, what are dreams?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have my ideas. And in some ways, the question of what are dreams gets to the heart of sort of Western versus indigenous epistemologies or Western versus indigenous worldviews, in that when I was writing Dreams, I couldn't find the book Dreams. I couldn't find any examples really of Western analyses of dreams that are interpretations of dreams that didn't that took dreams as anything other than, at most, messages from our unconscious. And that seems to be pretty much the prevailing thought in this culture, as opposed to, it's always seemed clear to me that dreams were messages from someone else, someplace else that I called someone else, I called the dream giver. And years ago, I asked an Okanagan Indian friend of mine, Janet Armstrong, where dreams come from. And she laughed and said, everybody knows the animals give them to us. And a different time, I asked Vine Deloria, who was a Dakota man, where dreams come from. And he said, the spirits give them to us. And my point is that there's this huge difference between sort of Western interpretations of it and indigenous interpretations, in terms of, with the Westerners, it's always coming from us, from inside us. And, you know, I didn't come to this analysis on my own through reading about indigenous peoples. It was just my experience. And I've had experiences of dreams for the longest time. I've had things that I called leakage, where, I might have a dream that makes perfect sense, except I understand all the dream, except for at some point in the dream, there's this blue car that almost runs me over. And this is a real example. And I didn't understand. I'm trying to figure out the dream. I'm trying to think of, okay, so the first car I ever owned was blue. So does that have to do with when I was 16? So no, that doesn't fit. You know, what else about blue? What else about cars? Have I ever been almost hit by a car? Couldn't make anything make sense. And then later on, I'm talking to a friend of mine, and it ends up that day she was almost hit by a blue car. And that was exactly the image that happened in the dream. And that sort of stuff happens to me often enough that I have a name for it. Like I said, leakage. So it's been pretty clear that there's something going on with dreams. And so I set out to write this book to try to help flesh out my understanding of our relationships with where dreams come from. And it's related to the question of where ideas for writing come from, that it's always been clear to me that I have a muse who is external to me, who is someone else. And so what are dreams? I guess if I had to put what I believe dreams are, I believe that dreams are messages from others with whom we can and should enter into relationship. I mean, it's kind of hard to just say that out loud within this culture, because that it's hard to not be classified as a loon or as some sort of new ager. But I guess if I had to say, well, I think dreams come from beings who give them to us.
Why do you think many people in this culture would consider you a loon for what you believe dreams to be?
A couple things. One is that the fundamental difference between Western and indigenous ways of being, so many indigenous people have said to me, is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive listening to the natural world as a metaphor, as opposed to the way the world really works. Another way to say this is that most Westerners generally perceive the world as consisting of resources to be exploited, as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. It fits within the whole dominant Western paradigm that we would perceive listening to a muse or to a dream giver as being crazy, because we also don't perceive listening to trees. We don't believe anybody. Here's the thing, is that the Western culture is so narcissistic, it doesn't believe that anybody except humans has anything to say. And that there's a long history of this and how this has been used to exploit women, children, other races, other species. That there's a great line by this Portuguese explorer saying that about the Africans, when they speak, they fart with their tongues in their mouths. The point is that the Africans didn't speak, according to him, which meant it was okay to enslave them. And that's been the measure by which, I mean, sort of the history of Western dominant culture has been increasing narcissism and decreasing ability to perceive meaning in the real world, in the outer world. So I think one of the, I mean, even if we go back in the Western tradition, only 300 or 400 years ago, prior to the so-called Enlightenment, it was commonly perceived that artists would have muses and that we didn't make up our ideas. We didn't make up our poems, our essays, our paintings, but instead they'd be given to us by muses. And, you know, frankly, a lot of artists still think this. Most of the artists I know believe that their writing comes from somewhere else. But anyway, back to the point that this movement has been of increasingly removing meaning from the world, and that makes the world a lot easier to exploit. Until today, you can have someone like Richard Dawkins say that, this is a direct quote, "Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command." And what he has done with that is conflate domination with the ability to know how something is true. You know something is true because you're able to dominate using that method of knowing. And that's an absolutely extraordinary statement. And on one level, it's true. You know, I know that science, quote, works, end quote, because when I flip on a light, you know, it turns on. But that's one way of knowing, and that's based on the presumption that everyone else is a slave that you should dominate, that electric wire, that rocks are slaves you should dominate to turn into copper wiring. And a way to think about this that I think should make this clear to most people is that, let's say that you and I are in the same room, and let's say that I have a gun, and I point this gun at you, and I say, you need to jump through these hoops, and you do it right now. And you jump through a hoop, and it's like, what do you know? I'm a genius. I just caused you to jump through a hoop on command. But one of the things I've done with that is I've destroyed, if I put a gun on you and I force you to do things, the chances are really good I'm going to destroy any possibility we have of having a relationship. And so that one form of knowledge, the ability to exploit, which is one form of knowledge, that forecloses other forms of knowledge based on relationship. The same thing happens on a larger scale. And it's even worse than that, because this attempt to dominate everything is killing the planet and will effectively end life on Earth. So it's a tremendous, at very best, it's a tremendous dead end. You know, I've been saying for a long time that science is an even better method of social control than religion, because if I don't believe in Christianity, then I'm just going to be consigned to a hell that I don't believe in anyway. But if I don't believe in science, then I must be either crazy or just plain stupid. And that's a much stronger method of social control. And I'm not saying, by the way, that I don't think that the methods of science produce information. What I'm saying is that they produce one specific sort of information that has ended up being extremely destructive and has foreclosed many other forms of knowledge. And an obvious way that it's foreclosed other forms of knowledge, that this dominant culture has foreclosed other forms of knowledge, is that it is, how are we going to know anything at all at this point about passenger pigeons? They've been exterminated by the dominant culture. And they weren't exterminated by science, but they were exterminated by the dominant culture of which science is one manifestation. That's part of the deal, is that science is a form of knowledge, but it's a form of knowledge that is based on a culture that is based systematically on narcissism and on control. So it's no wonder that you would end up with an epistemology where how you know something is true is based on whether you can control it, because that's what the whole culture has been about from the beginning.
You argue in the book that science is a monotheistic religion. You also say that it is the logical, religious, and intellectual heir to Christianity. Could you explain why?
Let's talk about the second part of the question first, which is how it's the intellectual and spiritual heir. And that is that monotheism, the sort of Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, Islam, one of the things that they've done really well is they have effectively destroyed meaning on the planet. That if you have a god who is a distant sky god, as opposed to numerous gods, numerous other beings, whatever, who live in the soil, who live in the forest, who are the forest, if you have a distant sky god, one of the things you've been able to do is you've been able to remove meaning from the earth itself. If you put your meaning and your divinity into this sky god who's a long, long ways away, one of the things that, I mean, that's the really hard part, is to remove meaning from soil, to remove meaning from your lover, to remove meaning from salmon, to remove meaning from all of your neighbors who live here and put them somewhere far away. And once you've been able to do that, that's the really hard part. It's much easier after that's been done to, for science, simply to go ahead and get rid of meaning altogether, to get rid of divinity altogether. And before scientists argue, oh, we're not saying that the world is meaningless, it's like, I'm sorry, you can't have mountaintop removal unless you believe that those mountains are not fundamentally meaningful. You can't have, you can't bomb the moon unless you believe that life, that the moon is meaningless. Oh, there's a great example. I just saw this the other day and just made me laugh and also, you know, got me really disgusted that Keith Olbermann was asking some astronomer, why bother to spend bazillions of dollars to go, explore the moon? I'm sorry, not the moon, but explore Mars and to try to find out if there's life on Mars. And the astronomer said, well, this will answer the most important question of all, which is, are we all alone? And I have another question for this guy, which is, are you fucking insane? I mean, only someone who believes that there is no meaning in life on Earth could ask the question, are we all alone, as we are surrounded by, you know, 3 minutes ago, before I came in to turn on the computer, I was out in this shed that I have, and I was moving some pots around, and I was disturbing clusters of harvestmen, daddy long legs. And I was feeling really bad about that. I'm trying to get them to recluster and all that. But the point is that they have lives that are just as valuable to them as mine is to me. How can he possibly ask, are we all alone? That's insane. What about octopus? What about salmon? What about red-tailed hawks? What about, you know, I don't know, Kootenai sturgeon? I mean, there's all these wonderful, beautiful creatures, but they don't actually exist to this guy, of course, just like they don't actually exist to the entire culture. I just finished writing an essay about how there's a sense in which we actually do live. I've been saying for years we don't live in a democracy. You know, corporations control everything, and yeah, of course that's true. But there's a sense in which we do live in a democracy. In that, I just wrote this essay because one of the things in the essay, they said I was thinking about tigers. I said, no, not real tigers, not the tigers being driven extinct, but instead I'm thinking about the Louisiana State University Tigers football team, because they're ranked number one in the United States, and there's going to be this big football game where people spend $1,500 for the cheap tickets, $5,000 for the expensive tickets, and there's going to be millions of people watching on TV, 70,000 people attend. They're closing schools. That's like, can you imagine closing schools and getting people to pay money to attend an event having to do with tigers, real tigers? Or how about, this is down in the Louisiana area, so can you imagine getting all these people to get together to try to do something about Cancer Alley? Which, after all, that's only children dying of cancer. And my point is that these tigers are more important than the real tigers to most people in this culture. And my point is that tigers don't have a real meaning for these people. And the Louisiana State University tiger football team, they do have meaning for these people. So all the meaning has been systematically reduced down to human creations. The only life that would actually exist would be life that this guy would discover somewhere else. And then, of course, the next thing they would do is attempt to exploit it. I mean, I think about this all the time. What would happen if they were poking around Mars and they found some, you know, fluffy creature with big, long, floppy ears and buck teeth? They'd go, oh my gosh, we found life on Mars. What happens if they find something like that on Earth? They put them in vivisection labs and test cosmetics on them. So anyway, how is science a religion? Sam Harris has said that there is no knowledge outside science. And science systematically, I mean, that's really just another way of saying what the Catholic Church used to say, there is no salvation outside the Church. And so my point is that it's really a monotheistic perspective, a perspective where you perceive there can only be one lens through which you perceive the world, as opposed to, notice when I asked Jeanette Armstrong, where do dreams come from? And she said they come from animals. And I asked Vine DeLorean, he said they come from the spirits. And I asked him about that difference in response. And he started laughing and said, well, of course you'd say that, because she lives in the Pacific Northwest, where the land base is much different. And so your entire cosmology has to be different. Your cosmology has to be different because in the Northwest, you have all these creatures that are trying to impinge on you at all moments, impinge on you psychically, where you walk through a forest and there's the energy of all the different trees, as opposed to the energy on the plains would be entirely different, where you have only a few megafauna and lots of grass, which would have an entirely different form of life. So that's one of the ways that it's really a religion, or I would say even a cult, that it can allow no one to believe anything else other than it. Everyone has to become a member of that particular cult. It can brook no heresies whatsoever. It can brook heresies within science. Now, there's arguments within science, but that's really no different than arguments within Christianity. It really can't brook the ideas. And it doesn't allow, I mean, in our standard discourse, we don't allow for the possibility of a land-based religion. I mean, I think about this all the time when I see some debate between Richard Dawkins and an atheist. I'm sorry, Richard Dawkins and a fundamentalist Christian, or Richard Dawkins and a Catholic or Episcopalian or something. That's what they're doing, is they're saying either God or no God. They're not talking about gods. They're not talking about a religion where you are embedded in your land and you actually listen to what the land has to say.
In the chapter How Do We Know, you write, quote, all perceptions of reality are and must be self-referential, end quote. Could you explain what you mean by this?
What I mean is that I can only know what I know. And, you know, what I know is that, you know, I'm holding my hands up in front of my face and I'm now moving my fingers. You know, that I know. One of the things that science keeps saying is that they don't want to have faith. But what I'm trying to say is everything requires faith, because I don't actually know that you exist. You know, you're a voice coming out of a computer. And it takes a fairly small amount of faith. I mean, I do believe you're actually a real person there. But let's take about that for a second, that I believe you're a real person, even though I've never actually seen you. And this is pretty interesting. I believe you're a real person, even though I've never actually seen you. I've just heard this voice coming out of the computer. But then on the other hand, I actually saw those harvestmen a few minutes ago, yet most people in this culture wouldn't believe that they actually subjectively exist. They wouldn't believe that they are... I mean, one of my neighbors used to spray them with poison all the time, and for no particular reason. I mean, they don't do anything, and he just didn't like their clusters. And so to do that, you have to fundamentally not believe that they subjectively exist on some level. You couldn't poison an entire community for no reason unless you don't believe they have fundamental subjective existence. And he saw them. It gets deeper in that, so far as science goes, they don't actually know how electricity works. They've got all sorts of theories. They don't even know how gravity works. So I'm not saying I don't believe in gravity, obviously, but I'm saying even their theories on gravity require a certain amount of faith. All I'm saying with this, and you know, before people freak out at this too much, also, this is fundamentally Descartes' I think, therefore I am. He was trying to find something in which he did not have to have faith. And the thing is, he chooses something different than I do. He chooses thought. And what I've said in others of my books is, why didn't he say, I love, therefore I am, or I defecate, therefore I am? I choose embodied existence as the basis of my faith, that I am a being who requires water. Without water, I die. That doesn't require a lot of faith. That requires a little bit of faith, because I've never died of not drinking water, but I know that there are others who have died of not drinking water. That's the start. Or I know I need clean air. If I walk into a really smog-filled area, I cough. It doesn't take faith to know that I require clean air. I know it doesn't take faith to require that. It doesn't take faith to know that if I drink water contaminated with gasoline, it tastes really foul. look, here's the bottom line. The world is more complex than we think, and it's more complex than we can think, which means that it requires some faith. It means that we need to fill in the blanks with one story or another. We can't see everything and know everything. That's just the wet dream of sort of a Christian God. That's another way that science is like Christianity, in that they want to get to this omniscience, and they want to get to omnipotence. That's all science is attempting to do, is to reproduce, is to become as God. That's part of the problem, is that at least with the monotheistic religions, there is this notion that there is something more important than humans, and there is someone who knows more than humans. And science doesn't allow that. Science wants to know everything and to be as God. It wants to control everything and to be as God. And all I'm saying is that all ways of life, including science, require faith. The world is more complex than we could ever even imagine. And so we have to fill in the blanks with our stories. And different stories can fill in the blanks more or less accurately. Different stories can fill in the blanks more or less accurately, and different stories can fill in the blanks more or less destructively. And one of the things that I say in the book is that Richard Dawkins says that the way you know something is true is whether you can cause it to jump through hoops on command. But I would say that the way you know something is true is whether you can live with it in place, way you can tell whether stories are true is whether you can live with them in place for 12,000 years, as the indigenous did where I live now, the Tallawa. One of the reasons the Tallawa did not invent backhoes is not because they were too stupid, but it's part of it is they didn't have this progressive mythology. They had a cyclical mythology. They didn't need to create a distant sky god, and they didn't need to create technologies because they were satisfied with the way they lived. The way they lived was working for 12,000 years. If your way you live is working, you don't need to change it. You don't need to have this restlessness.
Are you saying that science is inherently bad?
I'm saying that the information that comes from science can be useful, but I am saying that science is fundamentally flawed and also fundamentally pornographic, in that it is based on an unbridgeable subject-object distinction. It's based on the fundamental premise of science is that objects exist who are not willful and can be described through equations. And this is a really problematical and false assumption, because it seems clear to me that the world consists of willful subjects. And if the world consists of willful subjects, then much of science falls apart. I'm not saying that if you throw a rock, you can't describe its arc mathematically. And people would say, well, gosh, then that means that rocks aren't, you know, sentient, because you can throw them and they don't really have any choice. But the truth is, you could throw a human being too, and they would still describe an arc. Which doesn't mean they're not willful. It's just that if you put them in a catapult and shoot them, they're pretty much out of control. But that doesn't alter the fact that you have then thrown a willful subject. And that's a fundamental flaw in the entire scientific perspective, is the belief, it's the, at this point, almost entirely unexamined premise that the world consists of objects to be described mathematically as opposed to subjects. And this is one of the reasons this is really crucial, is because the managerial ethos really suffuses this entire culture. So they believe that they can manage a river. But a river is a living being. And a river has desires all its own. And as soon as you believe you can manage a river or manage a forest, what you're doing is you are, and the same thing happens with human resource management, that what this is doing is it's resourcifying the entire world, turning the entire world into commodities, including human beings. And that is a tremendously harmful way to look at the world. It's a tremendously destructive way to look at the world. There's a great line by a Canadian lumberman: when I look at trees, I see dollar bills. And if when you look at trees, you see dollar bills, or you see board feet of timber, you're going to treat them one way. If when you look at trees, you see trees, you'll treat them another way. If I look at this particular tree, see this particular tree, I'll treat it differently still. The same thing is true for human beings. If when I look at human beings, I see human resources, I see workers, then I'm going to treat them one way. If I look at human beings and see human beings, I'll treat them another way. If when I look at human beings and see a labor force, if when I look at women, I see orifices, I'm going to treat them one way. If when I look at women, I see women, I'll treat them differently. And so this is really, this is absolutely crucial. And one of the things that science does that is really incredibly harmful is it reinforces the notion that the world consists of resources to be exploited as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. That's absolutely horrendous and harmful. And it's like Vaingloria says that if we're to survive, then all of Christianity and most of science have to go. Once again, I'm not saying that science does not produce results that are useful. And I'm not saying that science doesn't describe some things. But what I'm saying is that if you perceive the world through a scientific lens, it can be very easy to objectify the entire world, which is incredibly harmful. And science reinforces an objectified perspective.
Besides dreams and science, another topic you explore in the book is civilization, which you argue must be brought down. Could you explain why?
Well, it's killing the planet, for one thing, and it has been for the last 6,000 years, or 10,000 years. One of the first written myths of this culture is Gilgamesh deforesting the plains and hillsides of Iraq to build great cities. And prior to that, Iraq was cedar forest so thick that sunlight never touched the ground. And the Near East was heavily forested. Greece was heavily forested. North Africa was heavily forested. This culture destroys land bases. That's what any culture based on overshoot does. And another way to look at this is any way of life that's based on the use of non-renewable resources won't last. And, I mean, it doesn't take anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that out, you know? If you have a finite amount of something, you're going to run out. And likewise, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that any way of life that's based on the use of hyper-exploiting renewable resources won't last. And, you know, when the Europeans first arrived where I am here, there were salmon runs so thick that people were afraid to put their boats in the water for fear they would capsize, and so thick that they could hear them. They would keep them awake at night with the slapping of their tails. And nowadays, the salmon are almost gone. The dominant culture has been here for 180 years, and it's trashed the place. And this is what it does everywhere. The UK used to be heavily forested and used to have wolves. I mean, for crying out loud, there used to be hippos on the Thames. We can't blame capital C civilization for that. We can blame agriculture for that because some of the people on the British Isles developed agriculture without the civilization, and they were the ones who wiped out the hippos. But anyway, so one of the reasons it's important is because it's killing the planet. Without a planet, you don't have life. Another reason it's important is because it's based on systematic genocide too. It keeps conquering more places. And how many hunter-gatherer cultures are left? I mean, prior to the beginnings of the dominant culture, there were, I don't know what, 10,000, 50,000, 50,000, 100,000 cultures across the planet. And it's basically reducing them all to one. First through Christianity, first through the Abrahamic religions, and now through science. And basically the religion that underlies all of those, by the way, I would say is patriarchy, which we can get into or not. But why is this important? Because 90% of the large fish in the oceans are gone. Because oysters in the Pacific Ocean are having reproductive failure because the ocean's acidifying. They're already having reproductive failure. And by the way, all the news articles that you read about this, the only thing they talk about is how this makes a hardship for oyster farmers because oyster farmers now have to raise the babies in tanks and then put them in the ocean. It doesn't say anything. They don't give a shit about the wild oysters or wild mollusks at all. They don't enter the equation. And that's this narcissism that is central to this entire culture and that's central to science. Who gets to observe? Who is the observer and who is the observed in science? I mean, how would scientists like it if orangutans began kidnapping scientists and trying to teach the scientists orangutan language? How would they feel about that? Would they think that that's an okay scientific mission? No, they would try to capture to free the captives. So the reason that civilization needs to be brought down is because it's incompatible with life. I mean, anybody who doesn't understand that at this point is really not paying attention. You know, they talk about wind energy, for example. This has been something that's been on my mind a lot recently. They talk about wind energy as being this great savior. But mining for the rare earths is creating these huge toxic areas all over China. And you can't take more than what the land gives willingly. So, yeah, it's not sustainable on that level. It's not, I mean, there are so many levels at which it's just simply not sustainable. And it's also not just, and it's not, it won't last.
Would you like to see humans return to a hunter-gatherer existence?
Well, the only way of living that has ever been sustainable, truly sustainable, has been hunter-gatherer. And we will be living sustainably one day as hunter-gatherers, or we won't be living at all. There has never been an agricultural society that is sustainable. And we can fantasize all we want about all sorts of magical industrial gizmos, but it doesn't alter the fact that they have never been sustainable, and they never will be sustainable on a functional level, on the level of resource movement. People talk about how they can make cities sustainable. It's like, okay, great. Where do you get the wiring for the electricity? Well, that means you need mines, which means you need to have sacrifice areas. Where do you get the water for New York City? Where do the waste go? You know, on a straight physical level, they cannot be sustainable. And an agricultural way of life also cannot be sustainable. The Fertile Crescent, Iraq was called the Fertile Crescent. It sure as hell isn't called that now. Systematically, what agriculture is you clear off whoever lives there, the prairie, the forest, you clear them off. It's biotic cleansing. You clear them off and then you replace it with one crop for humans. And one of the problems is that once you've committed yourself to that path, you can grow more humans on that land then by devoting all the energy to humans. But the problem is you're systematically destroying the soil as you do that. And one of the problems is that once you've committed yourself to that path of overshoot, you need to continue to conquer other places or your population will collapse. And that's what this culture has committed itself to for a long, long time. And it's reaching the end. I mean, we're out of planet.
How do we bring down or dismantle civilization?
Well, I think that if space aliens had come down and they were systematically deforesting the planet and they were putting dioxin in every mother's breast milk and they were changing the climate, guaranteed pretty much to make much of the planet uninhabitable to humans, never mind non-humans. They were killing the oceans. They were putting dams up on every river, systematically destroying life on this planet. We would know what to do, which is we would go after their infrastructure and we would destroy their infrastructure that allows them to do this. This is how every military strategist knows that the way that wars are usually not won or lost on the battlefield. Wars are usually won by destroying the other's capacity to wage war. And the dominant culture is waging war against the planet. We need to destroy the dominant culture's ability to wage war. And the way to do that is to destroy the industrial infrastructure. And this is what, I know this sounds crazy, but the only thing that's even more crazy than this is allowing this dominant culture to kill the planet. You know, it's like when people talk about all their so-called solutions to global warming that are put forward in the mainstream media, they all are predicated on, they all have this, what they're attempting to do is they take industrial capitalism as a given, and the natural world is that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And that's literally insane in terms of being out of touch with physical reality. That, because without a planet, you don't have any social system whatsoever. So my point is that any solution to global warming has to take the real world, any solution to any part of sustainability has to take the real physical world as primary, and industrial capitalism or any social system as secondary. The social system must conform to the land base. That's why the Talawa were able to live here for 12,500 years, because their social systems emerged from and were a part of the land base.
You say in the book that you find ridiculous the idea that there can or will be some sort of great turning or great awakening where people simply walk away from this culture's destructive way of living. Could you explain why?
Well, it's ridiculous on a bunch of levels. I mean, one is there's absolutely no evidence for it whatsoever. You know, carbon emissions were higher this year than they were ever before. And I don't see, I mean, the United States government is basically at this point attempting to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency. They've gotten now where they're actually fracking their own water supply. And this addiction's not going to stop. It's like Lundy Bancroft wrote this pretty interesting book called Why Does He Do That? Inside the Minds of Angry Controlling Men. And this book is about how abusers oftentimes don't change. And one of the reasons they don't change, they very, very, very rarely change. And one of the reasons is that it's a cliche, but it's more or less true, that addicts don't change until they hit bottom. But the problem with those who are addicted to power is that they're not the ones who hit bottom. Everybody else, those they abuse, those they steal from, hit bottom. So the dominant culture isn't going to change because the dominant culture isn't hitting bottom. The salmon are hitting bottom. The Delta smelt are hitting bottom. The Kootenai sturgeon are hitting bottom. The poor of India are hitting bottom. The poor, the indigenous, the world over are hitting bottom. Everybody else is hitting bottom but the dominant culture. And they receive tangible benefits for their behavior. So they're not going to stop. And even when environmentalists, for the most part, can't even acknowledge, when they say you can have wind energy, and they ignore the effects of wind energy on songbirds and on human beings in China. And when they say this, those are the people who are supposed to be advocating for the real world. And they don't even advocate for the real world. I see absolutely no evidence there's going to be a voluntary transformation. And I don't want to stake the life of the planet on something that I know is not going to happen. I mean, for God's sake, there's 70,000 people are going to attend the Louisiana State University Tigers football game versus Alabama next month, paying $1,500 to $5,000 a piece. And can you imagine that many people attending a benefit for real living Tigers? I just don't see it.
What would you say to someone who argued that the dominant culture can't be overthrown without a great awakening taking place, that it's too powerful to be opposed by a relatively small number of people?
The movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta, men, has been able to shut down oil output in the Niger Delta by up to 80% and oftentimes by 30%. And they've done this through sabotage, through blowing up pipelines, through kidnappings. These people are serious. And the reason they're serious is because their homeland, the largest wetlands in Africa, has been turned into a sludge land. And don't tell me that small groups of people can't do this, because I guarantee that the movement for the emancipation of Niger Delta collectively had fewer resources at the start than you or me personally. But they have been able to reduce oil output by up to 30% routinely, and in one of their strikes up to 80%. And they have fought against the elite Nigerian military and also against Shell's private militias. And yes, that's how they have, I mean, corporations have private militias. That's how they maintain their land. And they've won. And the thing is, they're dead serious and their lives are at stake. And so it's simply not true. If we had millions of people, we could shut this thing down overnight, just like the French strikes, where they were thinking strategically. They were putting their bodies in front of the oil terminals. And if we had the numbers, we could do that easily. But we don't have those numbers. We do have the numbers of men, though. We just need to have the seriousness. I mean, one guy, all by himself, one person, all by himself, almost stopped World War II. George Elser. You ever heard of George Elser?
No, I haven't.
Not many people have. He was a trade unionist who didn't like what Hitler was doing to the trade unions, and so he decided to kill him. And he got a job at a mine so he could steal some explosives, and then he was a watchmaker by trade, I believe. So he made a timing device. And he said he would sneak into this restaurant where Hitler was going to give a speech. And he, for months, he snuck in. And he carved out this hole on a pillar behind the veneer. And then he put the bomb there, set it to go off for 8:20 or 8:40 or whatever. And Hitler normally gave a speech, and it would have been right at the end of his speech and would have killed him. But that year, because of fog, Hitler gave his speech at a different time because he couldn't fly out. He had to go according to train schedules. Point is, it's 1939. Everybody who's written about German resistance to Hitler knows that if Hitler was dead, the war stops. And so one guy all by himself. And I'm not suggesting, by the way, that assassinations will work now the way they did then. What I'm saying is that one person can accomplish a lot with a long lever. And a few people can accomplish a lot if they're dedicated enough to it. It's like I was talking to a friend of mine, Darja Mayo, who used to be he did great work reporting what was going on in Iraq, in the invasion of Iraq. I once asked him, so how long would a bridge last in Iraq if it wasn't defended by armed troops? He said less than 24 hours. And That's what a people who are attempting to stop an occupation do. And one of the things we need to recognize is the government, the United States government, the UK government, they're governments of occupation. And so we need to take this seriously. We need to transfer our loyalties away from the system and to the land. And if our loyalty really is to the land, it really does become a series of pretty straightforward technical tasks, many of which are eminently doable. One of the things we have to recognize is that we're not ever going to, there will not be a majority of people who want to, who will give up the goodies of empire. So we need to simply destroy the ability of those in power. Here's what I'm talking about, is we need to destroy the capacity of the rich to steal from the poor and of the powerful to destroy the planet. And we're not going to have the majority of Americans or people in the UK on our side for that. And we just need to accept that. And we need to take that into our strategy, which is why I co-wrote the book Deep Green Resistance with Eric McBain and Lierre Keith, because it takes the idea that the understanding we will never have 100,000 people who really want to bring down civilization who are at the center of empire. We may have 5,000. And so what do you do? If you have 5,000 people, you have a different strategy than if you have a million. And so what this means is it doesn't mean that there is no chance. What this means is that we need to use different strategies. You can use, like Gene Sharp has written brilliantly about how to make revolutions, how to make nonviolent revolutions through mass numbers. He's absolutely brilliant. And that's what you can do if you've got the numbers. If you don't have the numbers, then you have to choose different tactics.
You suggest in the book, and you've suggested elsewhere, that few people benefit from living within civilization. Doesn't this suggest a great turning or great awakening is possible?
The thing I've read that's made the most sense to me of anything I've ever read about the problems of dominant culture, and I've written all these books, you know, with trying to describe the dominant culture's destructiveness, but the thing that makes the most sense to me of any is something Jack Forbes wrote about in his book Columbus and Other Cannibals, about how the problem is a spiritual illness with a physical vector, such that, like if I have the flu and I cough, then I can transmit the flu to you and you can then get flu symptoms. If, on the other hand, I have what he calls a cannibal sickness, if I transmit this cannibal sickness to you, then you can become a cannibal and you have to consume the souls of others in order to survive. It's a spiritual illness with a physical vector. And really, in many ways, that's the only way I can describe what's going on, because they're killing the planet. I mean, it's insane. I've written 20 books about this, and I cannot wrap my mind around. I mean, the oceans are dying, and those in power, even environmentalists, I mean, like Bill McKibben all the time says that what he's about is he wants to save civilization. He says that if global warming keeps happening, that it will destroy our way of life. And I mean, I'm stunned that he's been working. I've talked to him about this. I've emailed him about this. He and I emailed back and forth about this, very friendly fashion. I mean, I respect so much how hard he works, but I don't understand how he's trying to save this way of life instead of the planet itself. That boggles my mind when it's so clearly this way of life that's killing the planet. And that, the only way I can describe all of this, the only way I can describe, you know, sociology and psychology for me just aren't sufficient to describe the murder of the actual planet. You know, so my point is that I feel like people have this terrible, terrible disease that causes them to become, it's a spiritual illness that causes people to no longer act like human beings.
That reminds me of how in the book you talk about the dominant culture being a culture of zombies.
Well, yeah, I think that this culture has sort of zombified a lot of people. You know, I wrote in another book, Songs of the Dead, I wrote about how it's pretty interesting how a lot of parasites can dramatically affect the behavior of their host, so that you get like a really good example is the Lancet liver fluke, that it will be in a sheep or a cow, and then the cow poops and poops out eggs, and snails like to eat the cow poop, and so they eat the poop, and then the egg hatches inside the snail, and then burrows out and was released into the slime. And ants eat the slime. And now here's the interesting part, is that the flukes will then take over the ant's brain and the ant will walk along normally every day, just do ant things. And at the end of every evening, when it goes to sleep, it climbs up to the top. I don't know if ants sleep, but anyway, when it climbs up to the top of a blade of grass at night and then clamps on tight. And it does this so that a cow or a sheep would be more likely to eat it. And so my point is that the fluke affects the behavior of the ant. And the same thing is true for certain types of parasites cause fish to swim to the surface and flash their bellies. And that makes them easier to see. And so the seagull or the bird of prey, who is the next host, would then take it over. And so the behavior of people is so insane in the dominant culture that that's another thing I've asked is who's in charge? Who is actually in charge? And because what's happening is not benefiting humanity as a whole. I mean, yeah, humanity is getting greater numbers in the short term, but this is just, it makes no sense.
What would you say to someone who argued that civilization can't end without mass genocide taking place?
Well, I would say that genocide is currently taking place. And why are hunter-gatherers being driven out of existence? And why are they being driven off their land to make the Belamonte Dam? And what about the genocide against the hammerhead sharks? And what about the genocide against migratory songbirds in general? What about the genocide against bats? What about the genocide against amphibians? Why don't they count? Somebody once asked Noam Chomsky about this, and somebody asked, don't you think that ecosystems, don't you think that the natural world has its own needs? And he said, what do you mean, beetles? And yes, beetles is actually what I mean. Firefly populations are collapsing right now. And what about those genocides? And part of the problem is that so many people, even people, and Chomsky, don't get me wrong, Chomsky is the gateway radical for so many people. Chomsky has done such amazing work, and I have so much respect for his positions. He's been so fabulous. And he's done such great work. He was the one who helped me understand that the United States is imperialist power. I mean, I know, duh, but you know, I was raised in the sort of standard mythologist culture. He helped me understand that, and I will forever be grateful to him for that. And, I mean, Chomsky's not the point. The point is that the people who believe that to stop this culture would cause massive genocide aren't acknowledging, A, that humans have overshot carrying capacity, B, that genocide is already happening against traditional indigenous peoples all over the planet, C, that the dominant culture requires the exploitation of the poor. You can't have high-speed rail without having mines. And high-speed rail requires a lot of iron, for example. And one of the primary sources of iron in the United States is Brazil. But this way of life, you can't have a city without a countryside to exploit. And every cell in my body wants for us to have a voluntary transformation where we have a smooth and smart reduction in human population and in technology, but I don't see it happening. And don't blame me because the dominant culture is overshot. Don't blame me simply because I'm telling the truth that all of us understand, which is that we've overshot carrying capacity. It would be so easy to lower human population without causing any trouble. This happened in Iran, for crying out loud. All they did was change the system of social rewards so that your first child has free health care. Your second child has free health care. Your third child, I believe it was with the third child. They did this in the 1980s. With the third child, if you have three kids, you no longer get free health care for everybody. And then also, tax breaks for not having children. Also, on their soap operas, in Iranian soap operas, they would say, oh, gosh, they have this hunky male character say, hey, I just had a vasectomy. And that's all you need to do is change the social rewards, and it would be so easy. But capitalism, see, that's the thing that pisses me off about this, is that capitalism requires an increase in population. I just got this really horrible book the other day sent to me called something about the population myth or something. And it's by these Marxists who pretend that, I mean, I understand that oftentimes when people talk about population control, they are racist. And I'm very, very clear about this, that what's more important than population consumption. But where the people really lost me was when they were buying into the same capitalist myth that they said the problem is not overpopulation, but that populations in Europe aren't increasing fast enough. Populations in Europe have stabilized, and it's capitalism that requires growth. Anyway, so my real answer for people who say that bringing down civilization is going to cause to kill a lot of people is, okay, once again, first off, which people are you talking about? Hammerhead shark people? Are you talking about poor people in India? I mean, for crying out loud, there are people in India who are starving to death right now because of the global economy. If you destroy the global economy, the poor people in India would be better off immediately. There are former granaries of India that now export dog food and tulips to Europe. Second, if your concern really is for people through the crash, because the dominant culture cannot last, and there will be a crash, whether it comes through economic collapse, or whether it comes through peak oil, or whether it comes through brave women and men joining in allegiance with the natural world to bring it down, or whether it comes through climate change, it doesn't matter. Whatever it comes through, if your primary concern is for the health and safety of the human beings through the crash, then what you need to do right now is start preparing people for that crash. Instead of complaining because I'm talking about the obvious, you start preparing people by making neighborhood gardens, by teaching people local edible plants, by making this transformation occur.
My last question is one I meant to ask you earlier, regarding dreams. How do you know you're not projecting meaning into your dreams when you interpret them as meaningful?
Well, I don't, and that's part of what takes faith, is that I don't know that I'm projecting, except that I have had dreams before. Like I said, I've had dreams actually fairly often where I had someone else's dream, you know, like the thing I mentioned early on about the blue car. There's no way that could have been a projection, because everything else in the dream made sense except for that, until I talked to my friend that day who said that she almost got hit by a blue car. The same thing has happened many, many times. And I've also had any number of sort of precognitive dreams where I'll have a dream that doesn't make any sense until a few days later when some other thing happens that there's no way I could have known about. But having said that, once again, I mean, I'm very careful all through the book. I try to be – that's why I said that everything requires faith, is that I'm simply trying to be aware that I'm very – possibly projecting, and in some cases I am projecting. But my point is that those who declare that non-humans aren't sentient, or those who declare that dreams don't have meaning, they're projecting at least as much. There's no reason for that to be the default. That's my point, is that there's no reason for them to take the intellectual high ground and pretend that their way is reasonable. What I really want for people to do regarding dreams is to pay attention to their own dreams and to try to find out if their own dreams resonate with their life, and also to open up to the real world and to walk. Don't take my word for it. Don't say trees talk because Derek says so. Take walks through forest, and don't just take one walk through a forest, but the forest here where I've talked about the trees give me ideas and they give me words for books. I've lived on this forest for 12 years now, which is not that long. I mean, it's nothing compared to what Peggy Reeves-Sandia was talking about, but I've lived here for 12 years. I take at least 3 or 4 walks through this forest every day. So let's just do the math. That's 365 days a year. Let's say 4 walks a day. Let's call it 300 days a year. Forest is 1,200 times a year times 12. This is 14,400 times I've walked past these trees. And a lot of times I'm just, you know, a lot of times obviously I'm thinking about something else, but a lot of times I'm paying attention to them. And it's that sort of familiarity. And also I've protected these trees. I've kicked people off who are trying to cut them down. I've done all sorts of other stuff. I have shown myself by my actions willing to be in a relationship with this land and to try to do what's best for the land. And the land, in my experience, is responding to that. So what I would want people to do is not to go, oh, Derek says that trees can talk to us, so it must be either true or he's crazy. But instead, walk through a forest 14,000 times and sit next to trees and talk to trees and see if they say something back. And they may not. And one of the things I say all the time is that people say, how do I have an interspecies communication? You know, I don't. And my first thing is, first off, in human conversations, we have mistakes all the time. We always we have projection all the time in human conversations. A great example is pretty funny. I was doing my laundry at my mom's a few years ago, and I was folding my sheets afterwards, and my mom said, "Do you want help with that?" That's what she said. "Do you want help folding your sheets?" And what I heard her say, because, you know, she's my mom, and I got this whole long history, is, "You're not folding your sheets right." So my mom said, "Would you like help folding the sheets?" I said, "No." And she's like, "Okay, you're being kind of weird." And my point is that this is a relationship with a human that's, you know, at that point was 45 years long. And there was still this projection. And my God, this happens all the time in romantic relationships. One person says to the other, "I love you." And the other person says, "Well, I love you too." And one person means, "Wow, you're sure a great pal." And the other person means, you know, "I want to marry you." And so that happens all the time. So think how much more that can happen with non-humans. And so what I always say is, okay, and also, you know, say you're making love with someone. You don't always have to speak with your mouth. You don't have to say, you know, "Please put this there." Sometimes the bodies can speak without language. And sometimes there's projection there too. But then let's go to non-humans. And I always ask people, so have you ever had a dog or a cat friend? And a lot of them say, yeah. It's like, how did the animal let you know it was hungry? Well, it looks at the dog dish, looks at me, looks at the dog dish, looks at me. I mean, that's a form of communication right there. And of course, there's a lot more room for projection. Or let's back up a little bit. Let's say that I speak English and you speak Swahili. There's going to be a lot of space for a lot of projection in there, but we'll still be able to communicate through some basic human connections, through smiling might mean the same thing, whatever. And then let's go to dogs, but we still speak mammal, but we don't speak human. And then what about if you're trying to speak with a lizard? Well, a lizard still speaks animal, but it doesn't speak mammal even. So it's going to be even further away. A lizard might not look at its food dish, look at you, look at its food dish. But that doesn't mean it's not communicating. I mean, that's the fundamental conceit here with the dominant culture, is because they don't speak English, they don't speak. Because they don't speak human, they don't speak. But there's no reason to think that the harvestmen I mentioned early in the interview are not speaking and communicating with each other. In fact, when I lifted up the thing that they were on, they all started moving their legs. And what that does, that's an alarm signal. They're all telling each other, "Oh my God, this is terrible. Something bad's happening." And trees do this all the time. Trees communicate with each other. If some group of beetles goes after a certain tree, that tree sends out messages. It speaks. Why sends out messages? Why use that language? Why use the scientific language of makes chemical pheromones? It speaks. It tells other trees, "Hey, this is what's going on." And also calls out to ladybugs. I've seen this happen. It's pretty damn cool. That I had this tree when I lived in Spokane, Washington, this tree that got this aphid infestation. The aphids were going crazy, killing everything. And I'm killing all the leaves. And, you know, I was like, "Oh my gosh, do I spray it down with water?" I wasn't going to use pesticides. I was thinking about spraying it down with water, but I just wanted to watch and see what happened. And about a few weeks later, I saw all these little grubs on the leaves, and I started watching those, and they were eating the aphids, and they were ladybug larvae. And what had happened is the tree, and this happens all the time, this is not just me making this up, this has been scientifically tested, that the tree sends out chemicals, it sends out messages that attract the ladybugs. The ladybugs come to eat the aphids. So they're communicating. There's interspecies communication right there. So that's one of the reasons. How do I know I'm not projecting? Sure, I may very well be projecting. But don't tell me that non-humans aren't communicating, because that happens all the time.
Okay, Derek, thanks for talking to me.
Thank you. I think your questions are great.
Dreams is published by Seven Stories Press. The address of Derek Jensen's website is derekjensen.org. This interview was conducted by Richard Capes for the site morethd.blogspot.com and recorded on the 13th of December 2011. Thank you for listening.